there a doctor in the house?
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
Taking on bureaucrats and corporations that would stand in the way of health freedom and making sense out of medical propaganda. The voice of health, freedom, and liberty, Robert Scott Bell.
Hey, the greatest way to start the week on the Robert Scott Bell Show is, of course, with Dr. Rashid Batar with some advanced medicine. And, of course, many of my listeners, Dr. Batar, look forward. In fact, some of them say, Monday is my favorite day of the week, and I understand why. We get to do some things that no one else in media does with the insights you have and the insider perspective on a lot of things that you have. It's so great.
Well, Robert, it's always great to be able to share some of these ideas, and our exchange is always natural. So it's a welcome opportunity for me every week to break away from what I normally am doing. And I've actually gotten used to this Medical Mondays and actually look forward to it every Monday. So I'm pleased to be here with you as always.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. Like I said, when we get together, sometimes we will plan a lot about the show, and a lot of times it happens so organically that we'll end up covering a lot of different topics. Of course, one of the things a lot of people are concerned, as am I, to see how your wife is recovering from a few weeks back, as we talked about her finger being injured and some regenerative methodologies and trying to do new things. Has she continued? Because, you know, one of the more bizarre stories of the week, and I just covered this last hour, and Rand Paul in the Senate had said this, one of the things that makes you a suspected terrorist is if you have lost one of your fingers. And I'm thinking, don't lose your finger.
I didn't know that. Why is that?
I guess the assumption I say is that, well, were you playing with explosives or something? I mean, never mind that your wife was merely trying to break up a dog fight.
Well, I would think that if somebody had been messing around with explosives, they would tend to probably lose more than, I mean, if there was an accident,
I would think
lose
so.
More than a finger.
But then again, I mean, there are other things like having guns, and if you have ammo that you are like weatherproofing, somehow that makes you suspicious. And also, one of perhaps the most bizarre thing is if you have more than 7 days of food stored up, that makes you a suspect. I mean, this is the kind
really?
Of stuff that's happening now.
Wow, I had no idea about that.
Yeah, and Rand Paul was in the Senate going, what are you guys thinking? Because Democrats and Republicans alike, with some exceptions, not many, are basically passing this in as if this so-called war on terror is real, and of course they're turning the war against the American people, who they would say it's a responsible thing to have some food prepared for a disaster, except if it's more than 7 days. Then now, oh, we're not so sure about you.
I would think that that would be most aware people have at least a couple of weeks of food, if not more, stored up.
Oh, I would think so. And I would hope, and we encourage it, of course. You know, any kind of disaster that could be a temporary thing, like hurricanes, that, you know, some people have been out for back in Florida before I moved down, it was like 05, there was Hurricane Wilma. Some people were out of power for weeks.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And so to do that is responsible. We saw Hurricane Katrina, et cetera. But I think the concern perhaps is if you're too self-sufficient, you have no dependence on the government, and that concerns them.
probably rightly so.
Well, fascinating, though. So anyway, yeah, real quickly, how is your wife doing with her finger recovery?
She's actually doing fantastic. The finger continues to regenerate at an unprecedented rate. We've never seen digits like that repair. Now, we're using this technology. I'm not surprised the way it's working, but I have never seen something work this well. And of course, we discussed all of the things she's doing too. But
yes,
I would say probably, you know, a good 60%, if not more, if the finger's already back. Mm-hmm. We anticipate by mid-January that her treatment should finish. And I'm taking serial pictures. I didn't take any pictures today when we did the dressing change, but the dressing changes are being done every 48 hours and reapplication every 48 hours. So once I've got everything done, as far as all the pictures have been taken and then treatments finished, then I'll post the before, mid, and after pictures so that people can see for themselves. But it's pretty dramatic as far as how well it's recovering and how fast it's recovering. So it's not as if you're looking at a finger and then slowly it's difficult to ascertain if there is a new change or not. I mean, you literally see the various stages of the finger where before it was at the base where the nail bed is. You don't see any nail bed, and then you see early beginnings of a nail bed, but the finger seems like it was just cut off at that point, and then mm-hmm. you see almost a third of the nail bed there as if the finger was cut off at that point. So it's literally growing.
Fascinating.
With a mucous serosanguinous type
tissue
distal
coming?
End yeah. on the appendage, on the distal aspect of it. It almost looks like, you know, mucus growing there. The best way to describe it, and the way that the rep for the company describes it, that it should look like snot.
Wow, I love it. That makes all the sense in the world. My 11-year-old son will love to hear that.
Exactly. Well, here's the thing, though. I think the wound needs to be kept moist, uh-huh. and it allows for that scaffolding.
The matrix, so to speak, yeah.
Yeah, the matrix to kind of envelop the entire distal portion of the appendage so that there is mm-hmm. a framework for the new cells to grow into. And I think that's the reason that it's literally a layer by layer by layer that you see virtually in front of you growing. It's not how you would anticipate, because when you think of regeneration, you would think, well, it's going to start slow, small, and it's going to kind of grow outwards. Mm-hmm. It's literally like layer by layer, step by step. It would be like looking at a individual, and first you see the feet, and then the ankles, and then the knees, and then
right.
The
I can have a great visual there. It's like sort of like building a building from the bottom up, and each floor going on.
Exactly.
I can't wait to see the imagery. I mean, I'm not squeamish about these things, but again, it's fascinating this journey that we're on together that this would happen, and to reveal the things that are most exciting to me about regenerative medicine and all of the things that we're learning. You know, as we've talked about the silver and working with regeneration as well, and now this cellular type matrix coming the way it was described. By the way, everybody listen, the Advanced Medicine Mondays are, of course, archived at Natural News Radio. We have links up to Medical Rewind and Dr. Batar's site. You can give a listen the last couple of weeks as we talked about this from the initial stages of the injury to what's happening now. And, you know, this seems to be like the catchphrase, evidence-based medicine. Of course, you know that also well. There's an article here, Dr. Batar, and I have it linked up under Gaia Health. Evidence-based medicine is a fraud, and here's why. And they go into this whole idea of how the so-called clinical trials, which we've talked about, and rife with conflicts of interest, pharmaceutical, etc. Evidence-based medicine sounds like a great thing, doesn't it? But is it working out? What is it? Who's controlling it? Because this is really evidence, what we're talking about in your wife's case, but maybe not something that they would acknowledge in the old scientific realm.
Well, actually, at the end of the DVDs, the Know Your Options, the medical series that you know so well, Robert, since you did the introduction narrative on mm-hmm. them. At the end of those DVDs, I actually go into a diatribe myself about this very aspect about the term evidence-based medicine. And evidence-based medicine is actually a term that was originated from the integrative side of the house and, you know, the holistic side of the house. Mm-hmm. But the traditional medicine model took the word evidence-based medicine. It's almost like when you go through a divorce, you have you have one party that projects their own inadequacies onto the other partner.
Right.
And
right.
I'm sure you've heard this before, and it's the same thing that traditional medicine took the words evidence-based medicine, but yet even though they took the term themselves, they projected their own inadequacies onto the integrative doctors, yet took their own term by calling it evidence-based medicine. And in fact, what we do, what integrative medicine does, what holistic medicine does, what natural medicine does, is based upon evidence. As Plato himself said, that the true science is formed first from observation. The purest form of science is based on observation. And right. from that observation, you form a hypothesis, and then you test that hypothesis and see how many times it comes to fruition, and that in its entirety forms science. Yet, if you look at the double-blind, placebo-controlled, crossover, multi-centered trial methodology, it is based on anything but evidence, because there is no – all they're doing is collecting facts. I like to say that science is based upon facts, just like a house is built upon a foundation of bricks. Yet a pile of bricks does not make a house, neither does a pile of facts makes up science. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what evidence-based medicine, the conventional interpretation of evidence-based medicine, does. It collects a bunch of facts, but that doesn't make science.
Right.
And therein is where the problem lies with our modern form of medicine. There is nothing based upon evidence. If I take your hand and I treat your hand with, let's say, the black salve that they talk about, because let's say you had a growth on your hand.
Right, yeah, the cancer. This is a Native American-inspired thing. Greg Catron, of course, we've talked about here, was basically illegally extradited, kidnapped by the FDA to bring him back from Ecuador because he dared to sell and tell people what this was for.
Right, so let's use that as an example. So let's say there's a lesion on somebody's arm. It's growing. It appears to be cancerous. They take this black salve. They put it on there, and it gets rid of it. To me, that would be the fact that this lesion is no longer there. The evidence suggests that this salve that I put on got rid of it. However, in the conventional standpoint, that's not evidence. There's no evidence there. You have to do a double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover multi-center trial to determine whether or not it's safe for phase one treatment or phase one qualification for a drug, and then take it through the second phase and third phase before it can become approved as a drug. I don't understand that. What is that based upon? I mean, what's the evidence? You take two different people with two different with the same lesion, and you put one with the black salve, another one without the black salve, and it happens that one person responds and the other person doesn't. So what, you're saying that the evidence suggests that the one person that did get the black salve, that did get a response, that doesn't exist?
It doesn't count. Only the one that didn't work, evidently. In this article, it says we should first take a hard look at the reality, as we're talking about here, behind so many of the studies evoked to support evidence-based medicine treatments, EBM treatments. It's becoming a well-known scandal that much of what passes for science in medical journals is at best useless and at worst is devastatingly harmful, as demonstrated in the mass drugging of women going through the natural process of menopause. Great example there that they give.
Well, Robert, you look at some of the greatest studies supposedly where all this science subsequently has been based upon, and it's all been an illusion, a facade. They had last year, in fact, I think we covered it on the show, an anesthesiologist that had been paramount in a number of studies, I think 14 different peer-reviewed.
Oh, yeah, that's right. A lot of things were based upon his work, and it turns out they were all fraudulent.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and these are all university-based, all the highest integrity so-called, you know, the highest bastions of medical education, and it's all BS. I mean, you can get anything published if you have enough dollars that you give to the researchers. And then look at some of the studies that we just covered in the last few weeks, the absurdity of some of those studies. The one about sitting on a couch, it appears that is going to, what was it, couch potato, sedentary lifestyle?
Yes.
I mean, you know, what kind of absurd type of a study is that? So
right.
These are things that you don't, there's certain things that are intuitive. If you lay on a couch and you don't exercise and you eat more caloric, you take in more caloric intake than you expend, then naturally you're going to gain body fat. That's an observation. You don't need to do a study to, you know, establish that.
Well, the only reason I like them is because they make for funny moments of duh.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, Marcia Angle, or Angel, she has written extensively on these corrupt practices in science. She was the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. I interviewed her many years ago on the Robert Scott Bell Show, and she wrote an article called Big Pharma, Bad Medicine. And there was a really hilarious quote that she quoted somebody in there. The question was, is academic medicine for sale? The answer, no. The current owner is very happy with it.
Yep, that is a truism.
I mean, the ownership of academia is such that, you know, Big Pharma has a great gravy train rolling here, and the assumption that these studies are really legitimate, and, you know, and even when they so-called find the science is statistically significant, it's like, well, there's a 2% or 3% difference, and here you're talking about someone with 100% being better, like with the black salve. You know, how much more evidence do you need? It was good there. And, of course, we would look at individualizing a patient's treatment because we know there are basic things that are true to all of us. But beyond that, then we got to be very specific to each person. And we don't go, this drug works the same way for everybody, much less this herb works the same way for everybody.
And this actually brings the point about anecdotal response, because that's another very commonly used.
They dismiss it because it's anecdotal.
Exactly. That's exactly what they do. They dismiss anything that shows any validity by calling it anecdotal. But my question has always been that even if it works in one out of 10,000 people, mm-hmm. to that one person who got a response, it's not anecdotal. It's 100% of their experience.
Yeah. Well, and conversely, like with the vaccine issue, when they say, oh, it's only one in a million that are harmed. Of course, we know it's much more than that. When that one case, that's 100% devastating or deadly.
And my question has always been, what if you were that one out of a million that it affected? Then would it be anecdotal to you?
Mm-hmm.
Or would you be as dismissive as you are as when you just quote the normal statistic?
Yeah.
Because people aren't statistics. And I think that's one of the – you know, we can bring this argument into the realm of how medicine looks at people. And even going through training or in the practice of medicine, we often start to look at – and at least in the emergency room, and I know in certain clinics – you don't see how many – what the patient that you're seeing, you actually see how many more patients do I have left to see. And it's like, you know, you have a countdown. Like I've got 12 more patients to see. I've got 10 more patients to see. I've got 8 more patients to see.
Wow.
And you can actually see the difference in certain clinics that aren't like that. In fact, the place that we went for my wife, the hand surgeon, they were very different. It was not like the typical medical practice. In fact, they had some type of little sign that said, which I'm gonna get in trouble by talking about this with my own staff, but
uh-oh.
They had a little sign that said, you know, if you haven't been seen within 15 minutes of signing in, you know, please accept our apologies. We try to stay on time, but please let somebody know that you've been waiting. Now, my office, it's very common. Sometimes people have to wait an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours sometimes. It's sometimes really bad.
Oh, you are going to get in trouble for this.
No, I know I am. But here's the funny thing, though. I'll tell you, my patients, they usually, if they are going to complain, they usually only complain the first or second time. They never, ever complain. My existing patients, they never complain, no matter how long they have to wait.
Let me posit why this is the case. Because when you're with somebody, you give them all your time and attention and all that's needed, and they probably recognize that if you're not there, you're doing the same for somebody else.
That's you hit it right square on the head. I mean, it's you nailed it.
It's
my
so patients,
my staff actually says the joke among my staff is there's only one thing harder than to get Dr. Buttar into a room with a patient.
to get him out of that room with
that's
a patient.
Right. Get me out.
So listen, the only thing hard to do as well is to take a break because we get on such a roll here together, and we're going to do that right now on the Robert Scott Bell Show. There's a lot more healing to go on this Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Buttar. And there's even a new caller question that came in. I think it would be fun. We can give a listen to that in a little while as well and give some answers about diet, lifestyle, some techniques. People are very curious as they're learning about this for the first time. So stay with us. We're coming right back on the Robert Scott Bell Show with Dr. Rasha Buttar after this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show. Robert Scott Bell Show.
We are back, and Dr. Buttar, you were saying about the only thing harder to get, you know, get you into the next patient is the hard. I don't know how to say this, but it's hard once you're with somebody. You don't want to leave them because you're really giving them everything you got. And we'd love to see more docs, and there are good docs out there. We know and acknowledge them. We can't feature every one of them, but when we find them, I try to bring them on as well and spotlight the good works that are being done. Because this isn't a show about negativity, even though we have to acknowledge certain nasty things are happening out there, and we do so with the hopes that we can improve and give people different options.
Well, Robert, you know, let me just outline the reason that I do that, though. I'm not doing it because it's an altruistic component of me or anything like that. I mean, honestly, the reason that I do that is because one of the most important criteria in order to invoke the healing process is that the patient has to have the confidence in the provider to be able to help and guide them. And in order to do so, if the provider, the physician, is not able to, one, comprehend what the issue is, or two, is incapable of listening to the individual, sometimes it's just that. The fact that they know that you understand, or the fact that they know that they've been able to have an opportunity to convey their issue, in itself invokes that healing process to begin for them. So I want to make sure that every concern that they have has been addressed. And sometimes it takes more than an hour. Sometimes it may take more than two hours. Now, I've had sometimes where, you know, in 45 minutes we're done or 30 minutes we're done, and that's great. But a lot of times, especially in the beginning, there's a lot of unknowns. There are a lot of unknowns. There are a lot of questions. There are a lot of factors that still have the patient in a state of confusion. And so I have been told, if I've been told this once, I've been told this a number of times, I can't even count how many times, that the one thing that I do at the end of each office visit where I ask them, do you have any other questions? And then I summarize at the end what we have decided, what our plan is, and then I'll ask them again, do you have any other questions? The patients that I have done this with, which in the last probably 12 years has been everybody,
yes,
they have told me that that one step has been the most relieving component of their it's like it takes a stress off their shoulders because they know they have the opportunity to ask, even though they don't have – many times they don't even have a question because, you know, after so many office visits, everything's been answered and or that their questions have been answered or
sure.
We're at the same point of – knowing or unknowing, if you will. So we're in the journey together. So they don't need that hand holding so much anymore. But they said that's the fact that they hear somebody saying that.
Right.
I'll tell you one thing that one of my mentors taught me when I was in medical school. Mm-hmm. They said sometimes just putting your hand on a patient's shoulder, you know, mm-hmm. that's all it takes. And I'm sure you've probably seen that too.
Yeah.
And what is it going to take to individuals for the individual to realize that, hey, this person really, truly wants to help me? Mm-hmm. I've told the people that have worked for me, I've told them, even if you don't know what to do, I've taught the doctors that the answer course come through there.
Yeah, I was wondering how you get that message across to other doctors that have come out of traditional allopathic training. And literally, I mean, they're getting.
It's not just allopathic training. It's anybody. Sure. I've seen a lack of this in many doctors that have gone through the integrative training and the natural training too, Robert. Uh-huh. I've seen many people that are naturally trained that don't have this, and I've seen and that mm-hmm. need to be taught this just as much.
Yeah,
I don't think it's traditional. I mean, although I think the traditional model, the conventional model, is more deficient in this arena. I would agree with that. But
you're right. In the holistic realm, it's true. I found that to be the case. You know, sometimes people would come to see me and they had been to other homeopaths, and these others sometimes were working with great mysteries. In other words, I said, so after you had the experience with this and you weren't too pleased, you know, did they at least tell you what remedy or remedies they put you on? Oh, no, he wouldn't tell me. What? Mm-hmm. Are you kidding?
That's a very common thing where patients have told me that the doctor will say, so is there any other issue? And the patient will explain to them, and they'll write it down. And I said, so what did he do? Nothing. Did he say anything? No. Nothing. So he asked you the question, but he never did anything. That's right. He just asked me the question and didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that do? That abates that whole process of healing. It basically seizes that process from continuing, because all mm-hmm. of a sudden in the patient's mind is, he asked me the question, I told him what he asked me if I had a question, I give him the question, and there's no acknowledgement of it. They wrote it down, okay, well, I'll see you next time, and they hand you a prescription.
Yeah.
And it's something that
was
inside
it
yourself.
Was it a trivia question? I mean, what yes. Was there anything behind it? It was just social. I don't know. But you're right. This is really changing the way. And whatever background training you have or don't have, this is something that can help us in terms of just being with a friend, a loved one, and being able to understand these techniques. You're right. They can work for so many things in so many ways and provide healing well outside the realm of traditional training of any kind.
Well, that's right, and it's just simply listening. And I've had doctors ask me, "Well, how do you do this? How do you invoke that process?" And I tell them, "It's no secret. You listen to the person, and you give them the answer that they require. And then the question comes back: Well, what if I don't know? You know?" And it's the most absurd thing when I've been asked this question. So every day, well, what if I don't know? And I look at them and I said, "Do you have any?" I mean, do you think that I really have the answer every time? I mean, I probably say, in my clinic, we probably say, I don't know more than any other clinic in the world.
Yeah, I know. It's a refreshing thing, a humanizing thing to be able to say, listen, you might know more than me about this. You're talking to someone that comes to see me that has studied a particular area. So, yes, I've heard of it. I didn't have opportunity to look into it. I'd love to hear more about it. And I welcome the inflow of information. I could say, wow, another new thing. Just like in the experience with your wife recently, you know, you had to explore a whole new realm of area, put it to use and see what's happening. And it's like, it's going to add so much, not only for your wife and you, but look at what we've been able to communicate, where it's going to go from here. Who knows?
Well, we've already got two patients that we're going to be utilizing this on, and my mind's been on fire for the last few weeks thinking about the other applications of how I'm going to be using it, which they haven't even thought about using, but we've already mm-hmm. got plans to institute a couple of protocols of C. And I'm not talking about with an appendage. I'm talking about with organ systems.
Nice.
Using it in a way in conjunction with some of the treatments that we already do. So
very exciting.
It's one of these things that I do want to mention, though, because yeah. My biggest pet peeve in my office is if one of my staff members says, I don't know. So I don't want to get everybody mm-hmm. off on the wrong stand.
Sure.
Because to say I don't know, it's fine as long as the following words are, but I will find out, or I will do the research and I will give you an answer, or I will try right. to come up with a number of solutions. But just to say I don't know and leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, dude. Yeah. Don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't work in my office. I will tell my staff, you don't know something, you better tell me right after you say you don't know that you're going to find out.
Right.
And that's basically, you know, our philosophy at the clinic is to make sure that if we don't know something, you know, you never, ever, ever act as if you know something when you don't, unless mm-hmm. there's a specific time when I do act as if I know something when even though I don't. Okay, mm-hmm. This is my little secret. So everybody sure. that's listening to this, don't go out and share it with everybody. But in a case of trauma,
uh-huh.
when everybody is losing their mind, that's all the providers and nursing staff and paramedics, everything, I will act like I'm the most disinterested, bored party there
mm-hmm.
just to bring everybody's stress level back down.
Sure.
And they would, you know, this was a technique that I did because everybody would look at you and say, well, if that's the person in charge and he's so calm, then, you know, he's yawning.
Right.
Then what am I freaking out about? And everybody would calm down. And that's just to get everybody to settle down. And it's not really misleading people by acting like you know what's going on, but it's, you know, setting that.
Well, setting the stage for a healing. I mean, my goodness, to have that frenetic energy. You want to talk about a person that's in trauma and then the family around them, it's only exacerbates. It's not helpful.
Right. That's exactly right. It's actually, think of it as a natural anti-inflammatory. I'm reducing the inflammatory cascade.
Yes, exactly. You are, a non-FDA approved in that case. That's why it works. Anti-inflammatory.
That's right. That's right.
I love it. Well, you know, speaking of listening, we did have a call that came in recently. I thought we'd play it from a new listener, and maybe we can answer some questions. And if we don't know something, we'll say we don't know. Let's find out about this.
Hi, Robert. My name is Susan, and I'm calling from California. I'm a new listener, and I love the program. The information is fabulous. Have a couple questions. I hear a lot about the supplementation. I'm wondering what kind of diet you recommend for healing and being healthy. Is it raw? Is it, it's not vegan, I don't think. Things like that. What's the best diet? And what about carbohydrates? Because I think I'm intolerant to carbohydrates. Also, how do you do a coffee enema? And also, I've never heard of a green tea enema. Do we have to use organic green tea? Those kinds of things are on my mind. Just wanted to leave that. If you could stick it in a program, that'd be great. Thank you, Robert. I'm enjoying your show. I've become a faithful listener, even though I'm a new listener. Thank you. Bye.
All right, Susan, we appreciate that call. Fascinating, all the great questions she has. I think she's a prime candidate to get the book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away, though. You know, when you're just new to this and you're just like, I need to, how do I do? What do I eat? I mean, there's a lot of big questions in there, but a lot of people have them.
Yeah, those kind of questions would be difficult to really do. You could do a show on each one of those questions.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
Not gonna cover everything, so I would agree with you that the answers to those questions would probably be best suited for the book, not to.
No, we don't want to blow her off at all. But I mean, I think, you know, one of the things we both have come to the same conclusion, you know, we realize everybody's got unique needs and biochemistry differences and tolerances and intolerances. But the one thing we would want to say to Susan is that make sure the food you eat, whatever it is going to be, is clean as can be. I mean, we don't need pesticide laden foods. We want to avoid genetically modified foods. Whether you are going on the Paleolithic perspective, and I hear more and more people doing very well on that diet, or whether you're a raw vegan. I mean, if you're, I am not, and I've tested these things, and Dr. Bitar and I have talked about these things, and I think that you've just got to listen to your body and learn as we go here.
Right. I completely agree with you, and I'm a very big fan of the Paleolithic diet. Again, Paleolithic diet talks about essentially what I talk about in the book is a Paleolithic diet. I even discuss a Paleolithic diet, but not in specific terms. But again, a lot of the stuff is covered in the book, and not to plug the book here, but
I don't mind. You know, I love it.
But it does have the questions about the supplements and has the questions about the diet and many of those things. And I've been told that those were, you know, it was phenomenal information. I've had other people say that it wasn't enough information in the book and they felt disappointed because they thought that it needed to be more beefed up, that part of it. But, mm-hmm. you know, what I think people forgot to take into consideration was that the book originally, when I submitted it, it was over 600 pages, and they dropped it down to 300 and some pages. So there was a lot of information that was taken out of that book that I wanted to have included in there.
Right.
Because I was told that you don't want the book to be too long. It'll be intimidating. And yet, Robert, mm-hmm. one of the most frequently heard comments in my waiting room or from my front office staff mm-hmm. about patients, new patients that are coming in, they say that when they read the book, they were almost disappointed when the book ended because it was like they lost their best friend or they wanted to keep on going. I've probably heard people tell me that at least 4 or 5 dozen times, but I've heard my staff tell me that that's what patients have said too. And so I think that this concept of the book being too long or being too short, I think it just comes down to how much information, you know, if it's a comedy, you could have a comedy go on that's good, or if it's one of those movies that just drags on forever or a book that drags on forever, then people want it to end. So,
yes. Well, it's a good thing to leave them wanting more. And of course, that's why, you know, I'm never bored with anything that we do here. You and I cover some things. Sometimes we cover ground that we've walked on before, but because it is so, I guess that information is so lacking elsewhere that, as we know, repetition is one of those aspects that we have to repeat certain basics that we cannot assume how basic we have found it to be in our lives that people are there. And, you know, Susan's asking sincere and great questions, even, you know, on the issue of coffee enemas and green tea enemas as another method to help the liver to open up and detoxify. I mean, these are very empowering things.
Well, actually, on those two latter questions, before I actually talk about the green tea enema and the coffee enema, mm-hmm. I did want to say something about this when you were talking about sometimes we cover things that mm-hmm. we've covered before.
Yeah.
I think the first two shows we probably tried to create an outline of what we were going to talk about, and I think we ended up so far off that outline that we never even exercised that futile attempt again to try to plan what we were going to talk about.
So. No, it's like where the spirit moves us, and right now it's moving us to another break so we can continue on. Advanced Medicine Monday, Dr. Asha Bitar doing some medical rewind as we always do. Check out all the links in his book, his best-selling book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away. We've got that linked up as well. Coming right back with more healing after this.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
Robert Scott Bell Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the greatest show on earth.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.
Dr. Bitar, we were talking about Susan's questions, of course, a lot of things on diet, and we talk in general terms and sometimes specifically about diet on the show. But the issue of the coffee enemas, of course, you know Dr. Nick Gonzalez, he's a big proponent of them in his cancer therapy and many others, Dr. Kelly and others. But, I mean, it's something that still a lot of Americans don't know. They're kind of taken aback when they first hear about it. But when they realize how toxic they are and how simple a method this could be to help them, I think it's worth sharing the information.
Well, coffee enemas are something that I am a very, very big proponent of. All our cancer patients have to go through them on a daily basis. If you hear somebody say that you shouldn't do more than 7 enemas in a week because you can get addicted to it, I would not agree with that, especially if somebody is very toxic. Somebody has hepatitis, somebody has cancer.
Yes.
You know, somebody is very toxic. They need that. We actually use liver packs and coffee enemas mm-hmm. on a daily basis for the patients that are very chronically ill, like a cancer patient, for example. Mm-hmm. Without going into all the details, let me just talk about the difference between the green tea and the coffee enema.
Yes.
Two very similar techniques, but for different components. We don't necessarily recommend green tea enemas, although I think that they are very good and I have had patients use them. If there's any of my patients that are listening, please don't use the green tea extract that you take as a supplement for an enema. I mean, you can, but only take maybe half a teaspoon as opposed to, you know, and dilute that in water as opposed to somebody else that may be just getting regular green tea.
Right.
Because of the stuff that we use, Robert, is something like 72 cups of green tea.
That's too intense.
So it's very, very potent stuff.
And by the way, to Susan's question as well, of course, organic. You know, we're not talking about commercially grown teas that might not be clean.
Right, exactly. And green tea is a very significant source of antioxidants. Mm-hmm. It also is a metabolism facilitator. There's many components of green tea. And so depending on for what use you're using it for, if you're going to be using it for detoxification, I would stick to a organic coffee.
Yes.
People sometimes, there's many different ways of doing coffee enemas. We have a very specific way of doing it. And you know, just to cut to the chase, if people just go to, we'll have it posted. We'll have, in fact, I was just revising this week.
Okay.
Coffee enema process and our liver pack process. So we can just have that posted for anybody that wants to access that information. And it's a couple pages. It tells you how, why.
Beautiful. You know, as soon as you get that posted up, please let me know. I'll make sure I'll include it on the show notes, even if it's a day or two later. I don't mind, but I definitely want to get people, because this is a big, big question. A lot of people have, and I'd love to get that information out. Quite empowering.
Absolutely. In fact, Robert, just make sure, you know, next week that you remind me if I haven't already told you. But I literally had that on my desk on Friday because my head of nursing gave it to me to review. Mm-hmm. And my nurse practitioner had just gone over everything to make sure we had updated it.
I tell you, some of the funniest jokes that I get are from my boxing instructor who's from Puerto Rico, and he loves his coffee. And I told him about it. He says, no, I can't do that. No. And he's just, you know, for those that have a coffee-obsessed culture, they can't imagine. Why would you put it there?
Well, actually, it's funny because in the book, you know, in my book, I talk about the fifth step, which is the vices. Coffee is one of the vices.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had one of my patients tell me, Dr. Tarr, I am not going to give up coffee, but I will tell you that I have started taking it in the way that you recommend. And I said, "Way I recommend? I don't recommend coffee."
Yes.
And they said, "Oh, but you do, and don't you remember the coffee enemas?" That's how I start taking
it. Yes, that's classic. But yeah, it's so profound in how it can reverse a lot of issues, and of course, particularly with cancer, the most severe of these problems of toxicity. In addition to all the other things that you do, it's still a critical thing that somebody can do. And I would say, you don't wait for cancer. I mean, we all recognize that we carry toxic burdens, and these are things that we can utilize from time to time, if not in an intense way, in the case of those that are coming to see you.
Well, actually, Robert, if you'll indulge me, let me just go over a couple of quick things about the coffee
sure.
enema.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in my office, there's not a single treatment that my patients ever undergo unless I have already undergone it myself and my staff has. And I don't care what the treatment is. There's only one exception to that, and that is a coffee enema. I have never done a coffee enema, but I had actually gone over all these steps again so that I can actually start doing that. And this week is supposed to be when I start doing the coffee enemas. And I just, for whatever reason in my head, I just never thought about doing it. It wasn't something that I even contemplated, but I realized that's the one thing that I have never done. Every IV treatment, we've got 57 different IVs we do in my clinic for all sorts of conditions. I've had every one of them, higher dose, multiple times, you know, just to work out all the issues so that if a patient's having some kind of an issue, I know what it is because I've already experienced it, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And coffee enema is the only thing I've never done. So, and I mean, not forget about even the IV treatments, everything else from the hyperbarics, the Evox, the Zyder, the on-demand, every single thing we do, IRRs, all the procedures. I'll even have other doctors do the procedures that I do in patients on myself so I know what it feels like.
Yeah.
Coffee enema is the only thing I haven't done. And so the reason this came to fruition was just recently, a few weeks ago, one of my patients had told me, and this is probably my third or fourth time I've heard a patient say this, where they were so reluctant. Most patients aren't reluctant to do it, but they were so reluctant to do it. But once they started doing it, they said it was the best decision that they made because they just feel cleaner, they think better, their functionality, their energy, everything has changed. So for the people that are listening, to understand why a person does a coffee enema, it acts as an astringent. It acts as a sponge to suck up all the for lack of a better word, toxins, but there's many components. It actually is an osmolarity type gradient that's being shifted, and it acts as an astringent and pulls stuff through the colon. Remember, the colon is where the nutrients are absorbed into the vascular system, into the mesenteric plexus, and then basically the body absorbs the nutrition. That's one of the ways that the body absorbs nutrients, is from the alimentary tract or the gastrointestinal tract all the way coming down from the stomach through the small bowel, the large bowel.
Right.
And so basically the nutrient supply is picked up from the colon, absorbed through the mesenteric plexus, absorbed through the vascular system, taken through the blood, via the blood into the liver, and then the liver acts as a big oil filter. If you have a dirty liver, then all those nutrients are going into a dirty system. But if you have a clean liver, but the but the gut isn't clean, then even though the liver's clean, you're cycling back as it goes to the liver.
Right.
Goes back.
People can feel it too. If you know, some people will be more commonly saying, "Oh, have you ever had candida overgrowth?" And they'll say, "Oh yeah, I had the foggy head as such." And you know, whether you have yeast overgrowth or not, that same similar or sensation when you're toxic. For me, you know, as a homeopath, I recognize there's a point in the top of the liver in the back on the right hand side of the back, which we call the chelidonium point, that basically matches the remedy, the Celandine plant, chelidonium. And it can be sore to tell you there's liver congestion. Now, not a lot of Americans identify that. They'll say, oh, I have a pulled muscle, right? Rather than saying, I wonder if my liver is a little overworked or overwhelmed. And you do the coffee enema or you do the, you know, other detox, and suddenly, wow, I feel like a different person again, or a migraine goes away. All of these things relate to liver.
Right, right. And that's the point that I wanted to make, was that the liver and the gut are intimately connected. And so you really need to do both of them, because if you do one, if the liver's clean and the gut's not, or the gut's clean and the liver's not, you end up having that issue of what came first, the chicken or the egg. Because if one side is clean, the other one's not, the side that's clean is going to get contaminated from the side that's not. So they're both hand in hand. It's important to address them both. But we'll have the liver pack, how we do the liver packs and how we do the coffee enemas. We'll get those posted up so people can read them and understand them and then do them, and we welcome any feedback that you have on it.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to. 866-939-BELL. Just like Susan called, it's very simple for anybody to do that. Toll free, 866-939-2355. Give us your feedback. And, of course, if you ever have a question for Dr. Bitar, he's happy to take it on the air or off the air if there's some things that he has time. Not that he has a lot of time, but we get him every week for an hour here on the Robert Scott Bell Show, and we're very fortunate to have that opportunity. We're going to take a break, and we're going to wrap up Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Bitar after this. Stay with us.
In the health world through the power of radio, it's the Robert Scott Bell Show.
Dr. Bitar, you mentioned cancer, of course. We talked about coffee enemas and detoxification. Stunning story out of Great Britain. And what's even more bizarre, the doctor's name, Robert Bell.
Yeah.
title it through Sandbags. Listen to this quote, Dr. Bitar. This is amazing. The chief, if not the sole cause of the monstrous increase in cancer has been vaccination. Dr. Robert Bell, once Vice President, International Society for Cancer Research at the British Cancer Hospital. Oh, my gosh, the word is getting out.
Yeah, you know, my first response is tell me something I don't know, but I guess there's a lot of people that still don't know or don't recognize that. But, yes, I don't know, Robert, how long have you been hearing me talk about that?
We've been discussing this for so many years, but I think it's just too funny that the guy's name is Dr. Robert Bell.
Oh,
like, yeah, go.
That's funny. Yeah, that is funny. I was just looking at that, too. Robert Bell. What are the chances of that? Go figure.
I know.
So the name's Scott Bell Show, right?
Yeah, the name is worthwhile, I guess. But anyway, I mean, yes, it's not new to us, certainly not to you. We've talked about it even on the air here and talked about the increase of all these chronic diseases, autoimmune diseases, and cancer, and looking at vaccination as that gateway drug or intervention that literally facilitates lifelong dependency on it, wrongly so, but this is what happens, on drugs and allopathic doctors that are not trained or not open to the things we talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in this article too, it talks about how this is also agreed upon by Garth Nicholson, and I've talked to you about Garth before. I think you probably know him too.
Yeah.
He's the guy that actually was at MD Anderson when the doctor that was about to expose Harris County prisoners were being experimented on by some of the pharmaceutical companies that were producing vaccines. Harris County is where Houston is, and MD Anderson is located in Houston, Texas. And this doctor was mysteriously found in his hospital, in the hospital, in his office at MD Anderson, with a bullet in his head from a presumed suicide. The only problem was that the entry wound was in the back of his head.
Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, the media never covered this doctor, prominent doctor at a prominent hospital, who committed suicide with this bizarre method of committing suicide where you put the gun behind your head and pull the trigger and the exit wound comes out through the front of the head.
Yeah.
But Garth Nicholson talked about this thing. In fact, I think he's got I don't know whether the book ever came out. I have a copy of it, an unpublished copy, Project Daylily.
Yes, I remember we talked about that. This is, you know, again, stunning information here. The awareness, of course, you know, we're talking about a transformation of human consciousness, because without vaccinations, we see the children, growing into their full potential, which are, you know, they're considered superhuman, right? We've talked about our kids that are healthy and they're super normal, so to speak, and they don't even know what to do. But these are the kids the way they're supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a way that I've always felt that it's a way to dumb down the population. And when you dumb down the population, you control them better. And I think that's what you and I have discussed many times, Robert. And the fact that this Dr. Robert Bell, besides the fact that his name is Robert Bell, that's about the only thing shocking about this article. But I guess he's got a good name. I'm sure you'd agree he's got a great name, right?
Yeah, well, it's very powerful. It's a British thing. I've heard of, there are Robert Bells, but I thought of all of them that to say this is fantastic because, you know, these vaccines are like a governor on consciousness. They limit it so much. Yeah. On top of the physiological damage that they cause, it really kind of disconnects these children and then adults from really fully reaching their potential.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just introducing a substance that shouldn't be introduced into the body. And it's not even so much the vaccine itself, which by itself, the whole theory behind it is flawed. And there's so many other people that know more about this that discuss it. But, you know, Sherry Tempany's book is what kind of turned me on to and Sherry and I had lectured together in Malta. And that's when one of the times when I first sat down after one of my lectures, it was maybe after her lecture, and we discussed some of these things. And when I learned about the human mutated cell lines that were in vaccines and some of the other DNA addicts from other species like monkeys and chickens and rabbits and dogs that are found in vaccines that are used for humans. And so when people start finding out some of these components, it's very disturbing to say the least. And when people realize the facts and then they have the opportunity to make their own informed decision, then and only then can you say yes, it's good or it's bad, because now at least a person knows what they're putting into their body, and they've made that own decision, whether they've made the decision whether it's good or bad.
Mm. Well, the fight against fully informed consent, of course, is a fight against, I guess, revealing and acknowledging the great dangers, which are becoming more and more apparent every day. I mean, we got a flu season this year. They say, oh, my gosh, it's a mild flu season. Was it because they vaccinated 100% of the population or the fact that more people are not getting vaccinated that this is happening?
Right, right. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, so we really are living through and to some degree facilitating a lot of the sea change out there in our own spheres of influence that are growing each month, you know, each day, each week, in fact, because it becomes more and more apparent as people are, that get either we call it the divine discontent or just suffer enough that they say, this is not working. This old way is not where we've got to find something else. And they begin to open up because of the difficulties and pain and discomfort that they've felt.
You know, it's one of those things that I think as long as enough people find out that where's that critical mass when people get to the point where enough is enough. One of the videos that we posted that it was about Gardasil, and the video basically talked about some of the girls that have been injured, talked about a mother who discussed her beautiful daughter who died at the age of 23 after getting the Gardasil vaccine, and it had signs with a little break, which would be a patient talking about their personal experience with it, and usually it's the patient themselves, you know, a young girl, 16, 18, crying, talking about, please stop this. You know, I was an athlete before. I can't even get up and can't go and have fun with my friends anymore. I can't go to school because I'm in so much pain. And then they go back to another factoid, and it's a scientist or a researcher or a physician talking about it, and then they go to another patient. It was a very powerfully done video. It was on YouTube. We posted it to our list, and my IT manager told me that it was one of the videos, probably in the top 10 videos that we've had as far as that elicited response from the public. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, it's more and more people becoming aware, videos, radio, becoming aware of this message and then passing it on through whichever means that they have to pass it on. Mm-hmm. And as soon as enough people become aware, it'll just stop because nobody's going to participate in it. Nobody's going to indulge in it. Nobody's going to, you know, they're going to refuse to take these vaccines. And that's the only way to really stop it, because if you wait for the government or for a medical organization or somebody to come forward and stop it, it'll never happen.
Well, you know, you're a living example as to, if you will, the stoppage that is not requiring permission. It's not waiting for somebody. It's literally at one point we as individuals or as parents say, no more. I'm not waiting for the government to ban it, because there are a lot of people that will say, oh, we got to move to boycott, ban. No, just stop. Stop utilizing it. It goes away. And that is a simple thing, but it is a peaceful thing. It is a nonviolent way to do it. And yet we have to be willing to defend ourselves, even if it comes to blows, not because we desire that course of action, but they have to know that they are going to take their lives into their own hands if they come after our children with these things that could take our children from us.
Absolutely. You know, to me, I would much rather lose a fight up front, meaning if I'm going to engage with somebody in something like this, I would rather lose my life fighting to protect my family mm-hmm. than to slowly have my family and myself wither away from a disease that was introduced into our systems under the pretense that it was going to be something that's going to help us when right. everybody knows that it's not. I mean, everybody with the sane head that starts looking at the science knows that it's not. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to be lemming, and neither are you. And I think the masses are refusing to be lemmings. And so if you're a lemming, you probably – if there are any lemmings out there, Robert, they wouldn't be listening to the show.
Nah, probably not listening to the show. All those that do, of course, are pretty aware or on the road to that awareness. And if you have not already picked up the book, The 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away – Dr. Batar's Gift of Healing with that book keeps on giving. I've got links to that as well. We're out of time here. It is time to take a break until tomorrow's show. Dr. Batar, as always, man, such a great time together.
Robert, it's always good to be with you, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, thanks. And in the meantime, remember this, that the power to heal is yours.